The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. This morning, I would like to try to take you on a journey, and for which you'll have to participate. It's somewhat classically understood that being a student of the Dharma, listening to the Dharma being taught, is a participatory art. It's a participatory activity. It's not just sitting here for the sake of entertainment, but rather traditionally you would engage in what's being taught with your intelligence. You'd listen carefully, you'd consider it, you'd debate it, you ask questions about it. You would be open and receptive to it in a way that maybe would allow some of the truth of what's being said to affect you. Not affect you in the sense of, you know, you have to automatically believe something, but rather to somehow affect your heart, your inner mind. You'd be changed by the experience. And classically, Buddhism is a journey, though the word that the Buddha used was path. And some of you know that in the ancient world, they didn't have a word for religion like we have in the modern West. And and so Buddhism wasn't called a religion, but one of the terms that it's referred to is it was referred to as a path. Buddhism is a path, one path of many paths, I suppose. So it's a journey, and it's a journey that begins with you, because it can't begin anywhere else. And one of the things that, one of the ways discussion about how it begins with you is with a discussion of right view, that you have to have some kind of view, or you have to at least avoid certain kinds of views which are detrimental to being participatory, being open to the experience, to somehow being a, you know, allowing yourself to somehow engage in a deeper way. And so the description of wrong view that's given is that wrong view begins with not with a view that there is no such thing as generosity. There is no giving. And now I can imagine that one of the reasons that's said is that if you don't believe in generosity, that somehow, it's hard for me to imagine that if you held that belief, it kind of closes you up, closes you down. I don't believe in generosity, giving. There is also the view that there's no such thing as doing helpful and unhelpful things. The classic language is skillful and unskillful things. Again, if you had that view, there's no such thing as helpful and unhelpful activities that you could do, then it kind of, you know, what does it make you? It makes you into couch potatoes. You just don't do anything. Just kind of close up. And so the view that hopefully you'll have is that there is things you can do that are consequential. You can have, you can, you know, do helpful and unhelpful things. The other wrong view is the view that there is no mother and no father. I'm not sure what they meant by that in the ancient world, but I imagine that, you know, if, you know, I think most of you have some way or other had parents. And and the view, I don't have any parents. It's hard to imagine that having that view, you know, that without somehow closing up, resisting something. And so somehow some kind of openness to parents, your own parents, traditionally say gratitude towards your parents is an important part of the path. And the other thing is not believing that there are people who are well-developed in their inner life. The recluses, people who have some degree of attainment, maturity, wisdom. And that view that there's no wise people in the world, to go around with that view, there's no wise people. Again, I think that has an effect on the heart, on the mind, to close it up. That make us receptive. And so the right view is the view that there are wise people. Otherwise, why would you? And that'll allow you to be open to those wise people to listen. So that's one entry point into this journey. And I would like to take this journey with you into the Dharma, following the description that's given of how the Buddha gave a Dharma talk. So the Buddha would clearly, when he was going to give a Dharma talk, wanted to have an effect on people. He wasn't just teaching, truth like a dissertation with footnotes, just good information, but rather he was interested in having an effect on people. And one of the descriptions of the effect that he had on people was that he would instruct them, he would encourage them, he would inspire them, and he would gladden them. There's four impacts of listening to the talk. And I like the last one, to gladden, to bring joy to people as part of the impact of the Dharma. And so I'd like to follow a sequence, but before I do the Buddha's journey, I would like to offer you a modern journey, a pilgrimage that somehow is meant to speak about the Buddhist journey. This is from my book, A Monastery Within. At the beginning of every year, the abbess would meet with the new monks and nuns who had joined the monastery the preceding year. "Pack your bags," she would say. "I'm taking you on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of Buddhism." Knowing the pilgrimages to the places in India where the Buddha was born, enlightened, first taught, and died, the new monastics couldn't believe their good fortune, especially because, after their first few months in the monastery, some of the new residents were bored, some were restless, and some were unsure why they were there. On the day of the departure, all the older monks and nuns in the monastery stood by the gate to send off the abbess and the new monastics. Leading the group, the abbess first took them to a hospital. There they visited the sick. Then the abbess took the group to an old age home. The new monastics, many who were quite young, were amazed at the ravages of old age. The abbess then took them to a hospice. In the hours there, they spent time with people in all stages of dying. The last few hours were spent in silent vigil with someone who had just died. The abbess then led the group back to the monastery. There they visited a nun sick in the infirmary. The new monastics were struck by the sparkle of joy which radiated through the tired eyes of the patient. Then they went to visit the oldest resident of the monastery, a 96-year-old monk. The group was awed by the love and acceptance that shone forth from the toothless, frail, and stooped man. Next, the abbess took them to the hospice wing of the monastery. Here they were introduced to a nun who, only days away from her death, radiated a palpable peace that lingered within them for hours after. Finally, the abbess took the monastics to the meditation hall. When they were all seated, she said, "You have seen the holy sites. These are the sites that motivated the Buddha to awaken. Once you are awakened, you will no longer be troubled when you encounter old age, sickness, and death." So to go on a journey to somehow confront yourself, to meet yourself, to take yourself on a journey where we're going to meet ourselves. And I think that this idea of that the Buddha's journey, the way he would give a talk, was to lead you back to yourself, and in meeting yourself, to open your heart enough to be receptive to some teachings that maybe have the biggest impact when we are in a certain frame of mind, a certain state of mind. When we're gladdened, when we're encouraged and inspired, we can hear something we can't hear any other way. So there's a description of how the Buddha sometimes gave Dharma talks, what he would offer, how he would offer it. We don't know the details. We just have his little outline. I don't think it was his crib notes, but he would begin by giving a talk on generosity. And the talk on generosity was said to have an effect on people that created their mind, a receptive mind, or actually the word is usually translated into English as a fit or a ready mind, kalachitta. So a mind that's ready or fit for something. And so this idea that generosity is not just simply something that is good for others, but generosity and listening to generosity, be inspired by generosity, helps create some kind of readiness in you. And so he gave some kind of talk on generosity. We don't know what he did, what the talk was like. One of the surprises for me in coming into Buddhism was to discover the act of generosity, the importance of it, the value of it. I don't think I was a particularly ungenerous person before I came to the Dharma, but it wasn't just part of my vocabulary, it just wasn't my concern at all. So much so that I remember I was working at the Tassajara Bakery in the 1970s, a bakery run by Zen Center, San Francisco, and there was a Zen Center priest who was the manager. And one day I was in his office, and he opened a letter from some kind of neighborhood cause. I don't know what it was. And they'd sent letters to all the businesses in the neighborhood asking for a donation for this cause. And he read it to me, because I was sitting there. And he said, well, I'm gonna send them $50 from the bakery. And what surprised me the most was not that he did that, but that I was surprised that he did that. Why would you do that? Why would you send $50? And so that caught my attention, and I started then reflecting on generosity and what it takes to be generous and the value of generosity. And I'm moved by the kind of fairy tale story of the queen who was dying, and the wise minister says, if someone can find the elixir of life, we can cure her. And so one of the daughters said, I'll go off into the mountains to look for the elixir of life. And so the sick queen packs her with a beautiful piece of bread, big chunk of hearty bread for her journey, and she heads out into the mountains to look for the elixir of life. And the first thing she encounters is an old, starving, bent-over woman on the side of the road. And she asks the old woman, do you know the direction of the elixir of life? And the woman says, oh, I'm so weak and hungry. Don't you have some food for me? No, I just have enough for my trip. And she gallops off into the mountains, never to be heard from again. And so then the second daughter of the queen does the same thing. Same thing when she meets the old woman. No, I'm going off. Then, of course, the youngest daughter goes off to look for the elixir of life. She comes across the old woman on the side of the road. Oh, I'm so old and weak and hungry. Can't you give me some food? And she takes a big chunk, half of her, that bread that she was given for her trip, and hands it to the old woman. And the old woman says, thank you so much. And take a ride to the next tree. And you'll find the elixir of life. So what do we miss when we're not being generous? What do we lose out on when we don't open our hearts in some way? And, you know, probably, you know, it's not that we're going to miss some person who's going to point us, you know, right at the next tree. But, you know, we're talking about the inner life. Buddhism is mostly about the inner life, the inner transformation. And what do you find? What can you find? What can you only find if you stop and be generous? What is the effect on generosity in your heart? How does it soften you? How does it open you? How does it ready you? How does it touch into some qualities of yourself that cannot be touched if you're stingy or miserly or closed in some way? It's said in the teachings of the Buddha that generosity adorns the mind, that it makes you beautiful, the mind. And I think this idea of the beauty of the mind, the possibility of creating this inner beauty, this inner, I like to think of it as being sacred, is part of the task here. We all have this capacity. We all have something inside of ourselves that we can touch and reach. And so here for the Buddha, it began with generosity. And he told these, probably he told stories of generosity. Who knows what he did when he... There's a story of one of my American heroes, Mr. Rogers, that apparently he was honored at something like the Academy Awards, or I don't know what it was, some big thing like that for a lifetime achievement for all his years of offering this beautiful children's TV program. And so when it came time for him to accept his speech, or accept his award, he gave a little speech, and he turned to the audience and said to them all, "All of you have come this far in your life because of someone's generosity. Someone supported you in some way in your life. Someone believed in you. Can we take a few minutes in silence so you can each of you remember those people?" And probably the producers of the TV show are like, "We can't do that on TV. 2 or 3 minutes of silence." And so they panned the audience, the Oscars, wherever it was. And people were crying in the silence. So the Buddha began with generosity. And then he would continue his talk by talking about virtue, talking about integrity. And I would like to read to you a passage from one of my teachers, Upandita. "In fact, in the world, there is no greater adornment than purity of conduct, no greater refuge, and no other basis for the flowing of insight and wisdom. Virtue brings a beauty that is not plastered on the outside, but instead comes from the heart and is reflected in the entire person, suitable for everyone regardless of age, station, or circumstances. Truly, it is the adornment for all seasons. So please be sure to keep your virtue fresh and alive." When I was young, before my encounter with Buddhism, I thought that ethics and virtue were for them, those other people, and those people who were a little bit too good. I didn't think it was really, you know, something that for me, because I didn't want to be a goody-goody two-shoe, was kind of the idea I had. And so I kind of didn't pay much attention to that whole... I didn't have the imagination to be unvirtuous. But... which was lucky. But I... it wasn't really part of, you know, my interest particularly. And my... Really, the doorway for me, the entryway for me to the idea of virtue and inner integrity came from meditation practice. And as I became settled and calm and open, receptive, as I began seeing the beauty inside, as I began feeling I was the caretaker for it, as I began feeling kind of inner purity, then it seemed so obvious that I would caretake that. It's so obvious that I wouldn't want to somehow close that part of me up. Because for me, I could feel that there was an openness, a receptivity in purity. And that if I was thinking of doing something unethical, to me, I could, you know, at least the way it works for me, I couldn't do it or conceive of it without closing up, without tightening up, without narrowing down. And why would I? Why would I give up something that's so joyful or so beautiful or so wonderful, so peaceful, for something that isn't? And that gave me a whole different relationship to the idea of virtue than I had before. And I think the earlier idea I had, and one of the reasons why I was a little bit dismissive of it, was I thought it was external rules that you're supposed to adopt. That you're supposed to have these rules, someone tells you the rules, and then you're supposed to kind of follow those along. And rather I saw the possibility of not having any rules at all, in a sense, That are imposed from the outside, but have the rules, have the ethics, the precepts, be something that mirrors what goes on within, that somehow points to the inner purity that we could all have if we want. So the Buddha would give a talk on virtue. And this talk on virtue, the effect, again, he always wanted to have an effect, apparently. And the effect that the texts talk about was the effect on people was to help make their hearts, their minds soft, malleable. Some people translate the word as receptive. So talk on generosity was to make it ready. The talk on virtue was to make the mind soft. And then the Buddha would talk about the danger of sensual desires. And the effect that that was supposed to have on people was to free their minds of their... No, I have it a little bit wrong. So the next thing he would talk about was a talk on heavens. And he gave a talk about the heavens. And I don't know what he would do. I don't know what he meant by the heavens exactly. The ancient world, there was a cosmology of different levels of heavens. But I imagine that it'd be very much have the effect that it would have, like on me, when I think about my idea, non-theological idea of the heavens. I love astronomy. And the idea of looking into the night sky, and the idea of looking at the photographs they have for the Hubble Space, satellite. The idea, the telescope. The idea of looking at, the imagining the beginnings of the universe. Now they say that the universe was flat the first, few hundred thousand years, or basically kind of flat universe. I don't know, it's kind of, what was above and below it? And the magnitude of our heavens, and how all the atoms in our bodies were stardust at one point or other. We're not any different than what we see out there. And to me, I don't know what effect that has on you, but to me, I feel beautifully, wonderfully teeny. I feel like I'm part of this amazing, amazing, awesome, mind-stopping, mind-opening kind of event. And it begs all these questions, but I don't really want any answers to the questions. Why are we here? What's going on? Or what is this? And please don't try to offer me any answers, because because it's just that it's the awe, the openness of it all that I just find delightful. So the effect of talking about the heavens was to make the mind supple. So in a kind of like soft or sort of somehow, again, have an effect on the mind. So the translation I have here is supple. So then he would talk about the dangers of sensual desire. So you can a little bit imagine, after people have been inspired by these first three topics, and they come to sensual desire, perhaps, I don't know what people associated sensual desire with, but the dangers of sensual desire. Have you ever gotten to danger because of your sensual desire? If one or two of you have, maybe? almost gotten danger? what was I thinking? Why did I do that? And so there are a few dangers that people are familiar with. Certainly from, what happens with pursue our lust in the wrong way. There's other sensual desire, sensual desires for all kinds of sensual pleasure, alcohol, all kinds of things, drugs that sometimes get people into trouble, do things they wish they didn't do. But the contrast of a mind that's ready, fit, soft, subtle, supple, and a mind which is caught in the grips of the danger of pursuing sensual desire. Early on in my practice, I got involved in one of these kinds of dangers, without going into details for you. And I went on a retreat, and a meditation retreat. And on the retreat, it became obvious what I'd done, the harm I'd done. And the impact it had on me, the sense of remorse, was quite powerful and made a big lesson for me. You know, I didn't feel ready and soft and supple and inspired. I felt, you know, kind of small and in pain, realizing what I'd done. So the talk on the dangers of sensual pleasure is not supposed to be a party pooper. Sensual pleasures are okay, but there are dangers. And the dangers come about when we act on what's called in Buddhism the five hindrances. Five hindrances are unhelpful, unskillful mind states to motivate our behavior. And so to be caught addicted to sensual pleasure, to be caught by ill will, to be drowning in sloth and torpor and resistance, lethargy, to be spinning out in agitation and restlessness, to be weighed down and inhibited by doubt, are not states that keep the mind, the heart, open, inspired, supple, relaxed. And so the talk on the danger of sensual desire, the effect that it had on people, that the Buddha was trying to have, was temporarily to free them from the hindrances, free the mind from being caught up in these kinds of activities. And you can imagine that the kind of inspiration that comes from the first three topics probably settles some of the churning of the hindrances as they're operating for people. So then, the Buddha would talk about renunciation. And I imagine the Buddha was such an effective speaker. He had people on the edge of their chairs listening to this. And they kind of, wow. And then they came, renunciation. And so by now, it's been said that renunciation is one of the most unpopular topics in Western Dharma. And, you know, come to IMC and learn about renunciation. You know, probably you would have all stayed home. But renunciation is a beautiful quality. And so perhaps after, you know, the series, after the audience has been prepared by the inspiration of the first topics, they're ready to hear something different and new about renunciation than the usual idea that maybe renunciation is deprivation or a diminishing of oneself. I think the Buddhist idea of renunciation is not a diminishing, but an enhancement. It's for your own good and your own benefit. One of the kind of classic Buddhist, ancient Buddhist descriptions of this word, nikamma, renunciation, translated into English, renunciation, would be the equivalent of being stuck with all your relatives on all directions in a one-room cabin all winter long, snowed in. So it's nice to see your relatives, but, you know, all winter long. And then finally, the snow thaws and you can open the door and you can go out and see the great vista. And to finally get out into the open, fresh air after that time, that's nikamma. That's the renunciation, the association that the ancient tradition has with renunciation. It's the benefit that comes from going out into a wide, open space. I'd like to think of renunciation as simplicity. As I think that's for many people in the modern world can appreciate the value of simplicity, and especially people who have complicated lives with cell phones and smartphones and emails and Facebook and Twitter and work and, you know, just all this stuff. And we have so much stuff going on and some people are doing so many different things, it has an effect on the mind. And it's hard for the mind to be simple. It's hard for the mind to settle down. The mind becomes fractured. The mind spins out in many different directions. And I think most of you, soon at some point or other in meditation, will encounter the effect that your life has, how you live your life, and the kind of the concerns that you're involved in day after day, what effect that has on your mind, that you can't settle your mind down. Your mind is spinning outwards in many different directions. There's all kinds of concerns that are fragmenting it. Renunciation is the process of simplification so that this, the beauty of the mind that only can show itself when the mind is not fractured, only can show itself when the mind is not spinning out in different directions, divided to itself. And so there's a process then of settling down. And renunciation, this process of renunciation is in the tradition, is associated with concentration as well. It's not just simply renouncing, you know, the worldly things, but also learning to renounce, at least in meditation, the preoccupation with the many things that keeps the mind spinning. And so to help the mind become still and focused and concentrated. And the effect of this, last topic, the idea of renunciation that the Buddha was trying to have on people, seemingly, was to create confidence or a calm trusting. Be confidence in what he was teaching, confidence in the goodness of your heart, confidence of the journey, the path. But the word is pasana, which sometimes is translated as serene faith or serene confidence or serene, something peaceful. So what is it, what's your association with renunciation, simplification, that helps your mind become serenely calm and settled? And how do you find that? So the Buddha here is taking you on a journey. Journey through from generosity to virtue to heavens to renouncing of the hindrances and now to renunciation. It's a participatory process, somehow to allow yourself to be affected by this, to be inspired by it, to open something, to settle something. Probably it gives a sense of meaning to life and purpose. Probably it gives a sense of faith and hope. There is a path, there is a way, there's something to be done. It certainly is an antidote to closing up and staying closed or resistant or depressed or discouraged. And so at this point the audience was ready. And when the Buddha could tell, somehow or other, could pick up that the audience, the minds of the audience, was ready, soft, supple, free of hindrances, and gladdened, inspired, calmly, serene or trusting, then, and only then, would he give his core teaching. The teaching which he said was unique to the Buddhas. And so he would say it. And I would like to say it to you in a way that's a little bit different than how he said it before I say it in his terms. So imagine that your mind, maybe you can think, maybe not now, but you can imagine maybe sometime when your mind was most at peace, your heart was most settled, you felt most open and inspired, you felt a certain kind of elated or happy. So much so that, and you were aware, it wasn't like some kind of ecstatic happiness where you're outside of yourself and not in touch with yourself, but kind of a peaceful happiness where you're really in touch and you know from the inside, from your body, from your heart, your mind, what it feels like to be peacefully happy, to be settled. So you're in touch with yourself. And you know, and in being in touch with yourself, you then know what the impact is you can imagine, you can feel what the impact is of these next teachings or how it works for you. So in my rewording of it, if you cling, you will suffer. If you release that clinging, that suffering goes away. That is the teachings unique to the Buddhas. So after being prepared and ready and having the mind peaceful and settled, perhaps there's a seeing and understanding of how amazingly significant this teaching is, how it applies at the base of the mind, at the root, at the core of our mind, in all circumstances. And it's a portable teaching no matter where you go. It's true that if you cling, you will suffer. If you cling, you cover over the purity of the heart, the beauty of the heart. You lose it. And if you let go of that clinging, that suffering goes, that closedness goes, that resistance goes, that clamped downness goes. And what's left when there's no clinging? What's left is the beauty of the heart. What's left is freedom. And is freedom enough? I don't know if it's enough. But I know that anything at all that takes that inner freedom away is not worth it. So this is the Four Noble Truths that I reworded. So what he's taught was, there is suffering. Suffering arises out of our thirsting, our clinging, our craving. It's possible to release that craving and release that suffering. And then there's a path to do that. There's a journey. There's a pilgrimage you can make. And that sacred pilgrimage and journey is through yourself. You don't find the path of Buddhism anywhere outside of yourself. And it has to do with the views that you carry. Remember, I started the talk with the right view. It has to do with the intentions, the attitudes which you engage. It has to do with your behavior, how you live your life. It has to do with cultivating and developing your mind so that your mind becomes a beautiful instrument. So the beauty of the mind, so the stillness of the mind, the mindfulness of the mind, the concentration of the mind becomes strong enough so that you can stay really close to the core center of your heart, your mind, and see how the Four Noble Truths operate. See how the Four Noble Truths are the, if you really understand them, help protect the most beautiful and precious part of your life that you have. And so then the Buddha, so then, you know, in the stories where they, when they describe the Buddha giving this Dharma talk to people this way, then they would end by saying something like, and then the Dharma eye opened for the audience. Something opened where they could see something they couldn't see before. And it isn't like anything outside, right? The Dharma eye is here. It's something you see, something in yourself. You see a possibility. You see a truth. You see a path. You see a practice. You see a movement that you were all capable of. And so in that opening the Dharma eye, then clearly one person understands that the path is not found outside of oneself. You can go searching all around IMC for Buddhism and you'll never find it here, because the only place it is here. And so open the Dharma eye and become inspired, moved, and informed by freedom, the possibility for freedom. And then if you'd like. Then you try to offer that freedom, support that freedom in other people as well. You don't want to keep it to yourself. Share it with others. So this is how the Buddha shared it. So I hope that was interesting for you to see how 2,400 years ago, the pedagogy of the Buddha. May his pedagogy continue to move our hearts. So, thank you all.